The remainder of this chapter has to do with God telling about the great destruction he's going to bring upon the land and Jerusalem and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the fact that though they would have some very righteous people to live and dwell among them, they would not be able to prevent this great destruction. That is, they had already gotten to the point of no return now, so that he was going to bring the destruction about regardless of the prayers of the righteous. So beginning with the 12th verse, "The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when the land sinneth against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out mine hand upon it, and will break the staff of bread thereon, and will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it." Now it talks about the land sinning against me by trespassing grievously. And this seems to imply that they had become so wicked that the whole land was considered to be in a state of sinning against him. The whole land, it seemed, to have trespassed grievously against him. And this, of course, is what sin is. Sin is transgression of the law. It's trespassing. It's going out of the bounds of what God has set here for us to do, and rules, beyond the rules that he's given us to live by. And when we do this, then we're in a state of transgressing. We're in a state of trespassing grievously. And in the case of Israel, they had trespassed so grievously that he talks about the land sinneth against me. And of course they'd gotten to that point now. They were right at the point where God was ready to bring his destruction upon them. So he says, "Then will I stretch out mine hand upon it." To stretch out his hand upon it means he's going to bring punishment. He's going to bring destruction. He's going to bring his chastisement down upon it, meaning, of course, the inhabitants thereof. They would be the ones who would truly suffer. And he names in this chapter four methods that he's going to use to bring this destruction. And the first one he talks about is the famine. He says, "I will stretch out mine hand upon it, and will break the staff of bread thereon, and will send famine upon it, and will cut off man and beast from it." Now this staff of bread, as we know, is referring to the fact that bread is the staff of life. The wheat, the bread, is the basic food. And when it is cut off, when it is broken, when it no longer is there for man to lean upon as a source of nourishment, then, of course, famine is going to result. And it's a very unusual thing for a land to just have bread taken out anyway. It's usually going to be a situation where if the conditions are so bad that he can't have bread, then many of the other foodstuffs are going to also be taken away. It may very well be that they have, due to the seeds, just run out of bread. They're not able to grow anymore, and what they've stored up for themselves has been depleted, so that they're no longer in a position to have access to bread and the basic foodstuffs. And this is the one of the means that God is going to use against them. And we also can know very easily that it's one of the means that God has to use any time against any people or against any individual persons. Give them famine, not give them enough to eat. This is one of the most basic of all of man's requirements, one of the most basic of all of man's necessities, is to be able to have enough to eat. And God can simply take away the foodstuff that we have. He can so deplete or diminish it that we're in a state of famine and we can actually starve to death. Or we can become so debilitated until we're in such a weakened state that we're unable to fend for ourselves. And so he says in verse 14, after he has done given the famine and will cut off man and beast from it, "Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord God." Now, the people may have thought, well, we have enough righteous people here. We have some very holy people among ourselves. They're praying for this city. They're praying for this nation. They're begging God to have mercy and to not bring about this great destruction and to resolve this problem that we have with Babylon. And they're going to prevail, and God's going to let us off. But he says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, are in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness. So he takes an example of three of the greatest men in the history of man, Noah, Daniel, and Job. And he says, though these three men lived in this city, they would not be able to spare the great wrath that God's going to bring upon it. They should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness. As we look at these three men, we see Noah was a man, as we know, who was one of the ancients. He lived during the time of the flood. He was a very, very faithful person, although the rest of the world had gone completely amuck with sin. The rest of the world had so polluted themselves that God had to bring a destruction of on this world. He could not allow it to stand anymore. Noah alone and his family were the only ones who were fit enough to be allowed to continue to live. Noah was a righteous man. He was a preacher of righteousness, and he was able to save himself and his family by being righteous and by being instructed as to how to do this by building the ark. And so he then rose up among a world that was so wicked that he was allowed to be saved. And he would be a true example then of a righteous person, of a person that was righteous although everybody else around him had turned from God. And that's the case in Jerusalem now. If somebody was going to be righteous in Jerusalem, such as Jeremiah, he would be bucking the multitude of the other people. He would be out of step with everybody else because he alone, seemingly, would be the only righteous person left, or among the very few of the righteous left. And so his ways and his ideas would not be popular and would not be accepted by the majority of the people. And the next case that we'd like to talk about here is that of Job. Job was a man who also lived back before the time of Moses. And he also is an example of a case of individual righteousness. Although he experienced many, many adversities himself, he remained faithful and righteous to God. He refused to be put into the position of denouncing or cursing God. And so he's a good example of a righteous person who through his own faithfulness to God, did prevail in spite of all adversity. Now, these are two ancients. These are not people who lived during the time of the Jewish nation. They existed before the Jewish nation was even formed. But then he also takes a modern example, that of Daniel. Daniel was a man who had lived in Jerusalem very recently. He had been taken already as a captive to Babylon, but he was a person that they could be very familiar with. He was a very righteous person, and he was an example of a person who was a citizen of the land of Judea and of the city of Jerusalem. And he also was a very righteous person. But here again, had he been allowed to come back from the captivity and to again set up residence in the city of Jerusalem, his prayers and his righteousness would not be able to save it. The very best he could do would be to deliver his own soul by his righteousness. So the people then are instructed very plainly. They cannot look to the prayers of the righteous among them to prevent this great wrath that God's going to bring. They've already reached that point of no return. So in verse 15, he gives another method now that he can use to destroy the land and that he will use. If I cause noisome beasts to pass through the land, and they spoil it, so that it be desolate, that no man may pass through because of the beasts. Though these three men were in it, as I live, saith the Lord God, they shall deliver neither sons nor daughters. They only shall be delivered, but the land shall be desolate. Now here, you know, God is speaking in a figurative manner. These three men were not in the land. He's given an example, though, figuratively, as though they were in it, that they would not be able to spare the other people of the city. And so he's mentioned a second means now that he can use to bring destruction. noisome beasts to pass through the land, and they spoil it, so that it be desolate, and that no man may pass through because of the beasts. These could be large beasts that would tear a person apart in their ferocity and anger. This could be a smaller beast, such as a serpent, that would bite with a poisonous bite. This could be a horde of smaller things, like even the insects that would come through and make the land uninhabitable. It could be animals like skunks that would have rabies and have a real threat to life if they should get around someone and bite them. There's all kinds of ways that God could use these beasts to make the land uninhabitable. And he talks about using this means, and if he should use it, that these three righteous men would not be able to prevent it from happening. Then in verse 17, he talks about the third method that he could use, and that he will use. Or if I bring a sword upon that land. Now, to bring the sword is war. And that, of course, is what these nations that were going to attack Jerusalem would be doing. They'd be bringing war and the sword against them. So it says, if I bring a sword upon that land and say, sword, go through the land so that I cut off man and beast from it, though these three men were in it, talking about Noah, Daniel, and Job, though these three men were in it, as I live, saith the Lord God, they should deliver neither sons nor daughters, but they only shall be delivered themselves. So when God brings the war, he brings the sword, and this is one of the very, very common methods that God does use now to bring about his punishments upon a people or a person. Even the prayers of these righteous men would not be able to prevent that or to deliver the sons or the daughters. Then in verse 19, he mentions the fourth means that he can use to bring about destruction. He says, or if I send a pestilence into that land and pour out my fury upon it in blood to cut off from it man and beast. Now, the pestilence, of course, is disease. And there is a multitude of diseases that God could use. If we just would stop and think for a moment, there are many diseases in the past, such as the Great Plague, that wiped out whole cities. This could be brought back again. There are many organisms, germs, bacteria, that are in a state of semi-activity. We may not have even discovered them, and yet they could be brought to be loosed upon the people, begin to thrive, and wipe out whole populations of people. We have nations today that are prepared with germ warfare to do this very thing. They're prepared to loose some of these organisms that could make a whole city uninhabitable within a matter of hours. And certainly if nations can do it today, God can do it. So disease is one of the ways that God can bring about all kinds of misery. And as you know, disease can come in all forms and all degrees. It can be a totally incapacitating disease. It could paralyze a person. A disease that could bring instant death. A disease that could alter his health and his physical being for the rest of his life. All degrees of things can happen through disease. But he talks here about sending a pestilence and pour out my fury upon it in blood. Now, to do that would imply that it would bring about death to cut off man and beast. And he says in verse 20, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, as I live, saith the Lord God, they shall deliver neither son nor daughter, they shall but deliver their own souls by their righteousness. So these three men would not be able to spare the city from the pestilence or the disease that God would send upon it. So it concludes then in verse 21 about this. For thus saith the Lord God, how much more will I send my four sore judgments upon Jerusalem? Now, Jerusalem has become so wicked until God said Jerusalem is going to be punished more than anything else. I'm going to send these four judgments upon Jerusalem. And he names them here again, the sword, which is war, and famine, which is going to be hunger and starvation, and the noisome beast, which would be destruction by the lesser animals of creation, and the pestilence, which is the disease, to cut off from it man and beast. How much more will I send my four judgments upon Jerusalem? O Jerusalem had become so wicked until God is now crying that he's going to send these four judgments. And if we stop and think, we see these four judgments still in action today. Man still suffers from these four things today. And it's not for us to know just exactly how much of it is brought as a judgment upon the people and how much of it may happen by chance. But we have to believe that the mighty hand of God is very strong and very active even today in the use of these things against those that are sinners and to bring about his will upon this earth, just as he used it during that day against Jerusalem. And had we been in Jerusalem and able to realize that these four things were going to come, we would have all reason to fear, to tremble, and to wonder how could any be spared. But yet he says in verse 22, "Yet, behold, there shall be left a remnant that shall be brought forth, both sons and daughters. Behold, they shall come forth unto you, and ye shall see their way and their doings, and ye shall be comforted concerning the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem, even concerning all that I brought upon it." Now this is a very interesting area here. Although God has talked about bringing this terrible destruction upon Jerusalem, how that the most righteous of men would not be able to prevent it, they could only save themselves, yet he shows that he will extend an element of mercy. It's not through the prayers of the righteous that this city is going to be saved. Even the city of Sodom, had they had 10 righteous people there, God would have not destroyed it. But in the city of Jerusalem, it's a different situation. It had become so wicked, so provoked God, until God was not going to spare those that were wicked. He was going to destroy the wicked, and they were so numerous, so much in abundance, that he would then have to destroy the whole land, the city, the land, and the nation would be put to naught. But yet, in spite of all of that, he still was going to have a remnant that would be spared. "Yet, behold, therein shall be left a remnant that shall be brought forth." You know, as we read about the great judgments of God, we always have the remnant. In the case of the great flood, Noah and his family were the remnant. In the case of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot and his family were the remnant. In the case of the destruction here of Jerusalem, we still are going to have a remnant. And even today, although there's been the great apostasy of the church, the great Babylon has returned and has engulfed the majority of the people, there is still a faithful remnant even today. So there's going to be a remnant, he said, that shall be brought forth. That is, they're going to be brought into the land of the Babylonians, into Chaldea. They're going to be brought captives, just like you are, Ezekiel. They shall be brought forth, both sons and daughters. And showing that it was going to be a number of people, sons and daughters. "Behold, they shall come forth unto you, and ye shall see their way and their doings." You're going to see what kind of people they were. You're going to see that they were righteous enough, that they were allowed to be spared. You're going to see that they were penitent. They were grieving over sins. They were the kind of people then that God found favor with. "Ye shall see their doings, and ye shall be comforted concerning the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem, even concerning all that I brought upon it." You'll learn from these survivors. You'll learn from this remnant how that Jerusalem really was wicked enough to deserve to be destroyed. You're going to learn that I have done justice here, that I was justified in what I've done, and this is going to bring comfort upon you because you're going to realize that this is the only way that Jerusalem could be allowed to be put into a position to have been rebuilt again. It had gotten so bad that there was no other remedy. It had to be destroyed and at a later time start over entirely new with this remnant or the descendants of this remnant. So they were going to bring comfort. And true it is today Anytime we see those who are righteous enough for God to spare, righteous enough for God to have a great feeling of favor toward, it brings comfort to us to know that there are some righteous people still. Some people who will not be swayed or persuaded by the masses in their great and terrible sins. And so it is a source of comfort to us, just as it was to those people in Chaldea, and especially Ezekiel, as he met this remnant. So in verse 23, he concludes the chapter by saying, "And they shall comfort you when you see their ways and their doings." It's a wonderful thing to be associated with those who are faithful. When you see their ways and their doings, when you see how that they had come through all this, it's a comfort. Well, these people that were survivors of this thing, this remnant, they were bound to have had a lot of character, a lot of spiritual fidelity, and consequently it would be a comfort to people like Ezekiel. "And you shall know that I have not done without cause all that I have done in it, saith the Lord God." You're going to know when you hear the account of these people, when you really know how wicked and how terrible and how sinful this nation was, you're going to know that I did not do this without cause. God had a reason. God was justified, just as God always has a reason, and God always is justified, and God always is right. It was due to the great sin of the people, their idolatry. They had forgotten God. They turned against God. That was the reason God had to bring this great and terrible destruction upon them. You know, we live under the same God today. Our God today is no more tolerant of sin today than he was then. It just may be that he has a longer time of patience, but yet sin is going to have its destruction and its punishment. And consequently, we need to take a lesson from this, that what God does, he has a cause for it, he is justified in it, and consequently he is always right. Well, that ends chapter 14. Next time, Lord willing, we'll begin with chapter 15. Thank you.